Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
We have a new video on our playlist.
Yeah, from our favorite buddy, Richard Dawkins, right? Yeah,
right.
You almost met him when you went to England.
Well, we sure tried. We went to New College in Oxford, and we brought a beautiful, glossy printout of our Dawkins 3-to-1 evolution challenge. But we couldn't get to
him. Couldn't find him.
But we hand-delivered it to his faculty inbox. And people could look at that challenge at our website, rsr.org/Dawkins. It's a really fun challenge. It's beautiful to look at. You could print it out for an evolutionist friend or an atheist friend and say, here, could you answer this for me?
Yeah.
Because it's the simplest possible question to ask regarding how genetics evolved. It's like a baby step.
Yeah.
And we posit that it is utterly impossible for any materialist, atheist, evolutionist to ever answer the question. Theistic evolution, they can never answer the question, never, because it is unanswerable from their perspective.
Do you think when we get to heaven, we'll be able to watch a video of what happened to that thing? Like, did it get past the administrators? Did it actually make it into Dawkins' hands? And he kind of glanced at it, and then he got mad, he kind of said it, and then he looked at it again, and Or did it just go straight
somehow,
in the trash can?
Somehow it ended up on his desk, but then somebody turned on the air conditioning and it blew onto the coffee cart.
Yeah.
And that went into the cafeteria, and Dawkins was getting ready to pick up a cup of coffee, and he sees this
sees it there.
Yeah. So it's such a fun challenge because it has to do with symbolism, which is a major part of genetics.
Yeah.
And the laws of physics and chemistry have no symbolic logic functions. So they can't give rise to symbolism.
Exactly.
It's not a physical thing. There's no physical connection between the object and the code that symbolizes the object.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it cannot arise from a materialist system. By definition, it can't.
It can't. It has to come from intelligence.
Yes. I just love it.
Speaking of intelligence or lack thereof, this video is, I'd say it's the latter, lack thereof.
All right. So for years, we've been saying on Real Science Radio that the most famous atheist is the one who could say the greatest absurdity with the straightest face. And if you could do that, you could be famous. But you got to beat Stephen Hawking and Richard Dawkins because they say really stupid things with especially straight faces.
Yeah.
Especially Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking has some real doozies,
doesn't
he?
Just bizarre beyond imagination. So we've got a 2-minute video from Richard Dawkins. He's down in Australia on a panel with a cardinal and with the moderator.
Yep.
Not a bird.
Yeah, not a football player.
A religious leader.
Yep.
And he is talking about, he's responding to a question from the audience about how could the enormous universe come from nothing.
From nothing.
Right. So this is a fun video. Folks will be able to see it embedded on today's show page at rsr.org. But then we will share with you the text that's on the screen, since you're only going to hear the audio track. So there's a question, how could the enormous universe come from nothing? So here it is.
Physicists are still working on the origin of the cosmos. Among them is Lawrence Krauss, whom I shall be talking to next week. Now, it is very mysterious how the universe came into being. It's a deeply mysterious and interesting question.
And can I just interrupt? It's an old question, a very old question. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century was asking this same question. He said there must have been a time when no physical things existed, but something can't come from nothing. That was his view. It's just repeated by us.
Something can come from nothing, and that's what physicists are now telling us. I could give you, you asked me to give you a layman's interpretation. It would be a very, very layman's interpretation. When you have matter and antimatter, and you put them together, they cancel each other out and give rise to nothing.
So it says false on the screen with an RSR logo. They give rise to energy. Total mass and energy is conserved. So, Fred, that's not a layman's explanation. That is a false explanation.
Oh, it's a false explanation.
Yeah.
So, again, matter and antimatter, he says, makes nothing.
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 And he needs it to make nothing to make his next point, but they don't make nothing.
They don't make nothing.
There's an exact equivalent.
Yeah.
You haven't
it's
gone
a physical
from,
law of science. I want to know who these physicists are, Stephen Hawking.
Really, this is physics 101.
It is. It's 101.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So let's continue.
What Lawrence Krauss is now suggesting is that if you start with nothing, the process can go into reverse and produce matter and antimatter.
All right. So once again, false. Wow. And so it's false in two ways. First of all, you don't have nothing and get matter and antimatter.
Yeah.
You would need a universe worth of energy to get all the matter we have in the universe. Actually, it's supposed to have an equal amount of antimatter then if the Big Bang were true,
but we
don't.
That's another question. Where's all the antimatter?
Right. So that's another way to falsify the Big Bang theory. And if you look at our list of Big Bang predictions, man, you could see the reality of the history of the theory's predictions. And it is not the canonical story that you hear on Nova or PBS or the BBC. So we stopped the tape, put up our logo, RSR, and said this is false also, but then it continues.
The theory is still being worked out.
Well, there are many troubles with Richard's teachings, but a fundamental one is that he dumbs down God and he soups up nothing.
You can dispute exactly what's meant by nothing, but whatever it is, it's very, very simple. And why is that funny?
It's funny. Funny, Richard.
Well, I think it's a bit funny to be trying to define nothing.
And then this is classic, Fred, where Richard Dawkins is trying to find words.
Yeah.
And the cardinal is just taking a sip of water. And we have our quote come up at the end of the video. And it says, it has our RSR logo. The most famous atheist is the one who can say the greatest absurdity with the straightest face.
Yeah, that's perfect.
So fun.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And then see also rsr.org/Dawkins and rsr.org/Krauss.
And this will be embedded in the show, too, on the website.
Today's show summary, rsr.org, it'll be right there. So we like to chide Richard Dawkins, Stephen Hawking, any of these guys.
Yeah, yep.
You know, Hawking says that the entire solar system is insignificant. The Earth is insignificant. Mm-hmm. Well, if that were true, certainly he's insignificant too.
Yeah.
And imagine if you treated him in an insignificant way. Mm-hmm. Many years ago, we got the same voice synthesis that he uses for his voice, and we did a mini interview with Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
And
that was a classic.
And well, basically what happened was I said, oh, we don't have time for you. And I went on to something else, just dismissed him at the beginning of the interview. And it was like, he would have no grounds to be offended because he's insignificant.
He's part of the insignificance.
Right. If the whole world is insignificant, but of course, each individual human being, including Stephen Hawking, each one has eternal value and worth.
Yes.
Each one.
Yeah.
So, but he hates God, so he's going to live without God forever unless he humbles himself.
Yeah, before he dies. Now, remember Richard Dawkins when he was asked to name one example of an increase in genetic information?
Oh.
And he just sat there with a blank look on his face. You know, they actually cut out part of that because it was a lengthy.
It's so
him just sitting there trying
painful.
To think of one.
To watch. Yeah. It really was painful. Yeah. I felt bad for him because he's the world's leading expert on Darwinism.
Yeah.
And he couldn't give a single explanation. There's other examples of that, like when Ben Stein asked him a question in the movie Expelled.
Yeah, Expelled. I remember that. I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, no intelligence allowed.
Yep.
And Ben Stein said, well, Richard, where do you think life came from? And he said, well, it could be perhaps molecular biology will give us evidence that it came from some intelligent species from a galaxy far, far away. He's saying this like he watches Star Wars too much.
Yeah.
In other words, molecular biology might indicate that life is designed, which it does.
Yes, it does.
So here's Richard Dawkins vindicating the central argument of the intelligent design movement. It was a stunning thing. And then in his justification afterward, because atheists were just so upset, he wrote this lengthy, lengthy explanation that amounted to nothing. It was just obfuscation.
Yeah. So, and you know, Dawkins, these atheists, they have this fascination with aliens. Because yeah. Wasn't it Hawking who said, either ignore aliens or be nice to them if you meet them?
Yeah. Right, because they're likely...
they're likely to kill you.
They're likely to be hostile.
Too many Orson Welles movies for these guys.
Yeah, I think so. We made an alien version of the fish. You know, the Christian fish? And they make a Darwin version
yeah.
of a fish eating the Christian fish. And so we made an alien version, put it upright, standing on its fins with antenna on its head. And it says Dawkins on it. Because Dawkins suggests that maybe we came from aliens. But when they deny God, they will accept any absurdity. And so now they're accepting the multiverse, that there's an infinite number of universes.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you have the fine tuning of our universe, which shows the hand of God.
Yeah. They tell these fantasy stories. It's amazing. They cook these things up and act like it's science. That's what's amazing.
Yeah.
He was acting like that with science.
Yes.
He's trying to present himself as physicists say that they now understand how we can have nothing. No, they don't.
How
you have a couple of
the
clowns.
The universe from nothing.
Yeah. There's no physics behind it.
Right. And even Lawrence Krauss, he used his friend, Richard Dawkins. They're pretty close friends.
Mm-hmm.
He used him. Because Dawkins never read Krauss's book, Universe from Nothing.
Yeah.
But Krauss asked him to write a preface. He did. And he said, in this book, when Lawrence Krauss says a universe from nothing, that's exactly what he means. The physical universe arising from absolutely nothing. That's what the physics is showing us. Krauss, it's as though he hates his friend. He used him and made him look like a buffoon. And that cardinal in there, mm-hmm. he called Dawkins on this. He said, you didn't even read the book because Krauss doesn't say it's from nothing. That's just the title that he used to get people to buy the book. But he says that there's all these quantum forces, yep. a quantum field, and he thinks, he proposes the universe came from that, but that only punts because then where did that come from?
Yeah.
So if that's been eternal, well, then why can't the universe be eternal?
Yeah.
So either you have eternal matter or eternal God.
Yeah, they're always punting. They're yes. punting out to space. They're punting to aliens. Who created the aliens?
Right. And if life didn't evolve on Earth because there wasn't enough time, where'd it evolve on Mars? Same amount
yeah.
of time.
Yeah.
What, another galaxy? You just double the time. That's about it.
Yep.
You get either Earth or double the time, maybe triple it, then you're done. So it's not like you get a trillion times more time if you want life to evolve somewhere else. And it can't anyway because it can't provide the symbolic coding needed for the genetic basis of biological life.
That's right. So, Bob, you went on a really neat field trip.
Yes.
To Glacier National Park. In fact, we talked a little bit while you were at the hotel. I was actually at work, and you're having fun. I was a little bit jealous, but, you know, I got over it.
Glacier in Montana. We were in Kalispell.
Kalispell, yeah.
Getting ready to head off. This was a GSA, Geological Society of America, field trip. And the reason I went on it was because Dr. Walt Brown, our favorite scientist, the modern day Isaac Newton, Dr. Walt Brown was going on the trip because his book in the beginning deals with the formation of mountains and sediments and layers and the rapid stratification of thousands of layers. And he wanted to go to Glacier because that's where they have the Lewis Overthrust Fault, and other astounding features.
So there's a lot of scientists, a lot of geologists going to this. And
yes.
All of them are secular, right?
Yeah.
They all believe in an old Earth.
A dozen secular geologists
yep.
from Japan to Montreal.
And you met one of them coming off the airplane in the shuttle coming to the hotel.
That's right.
And I was talking to you about that. And I was like, Bob, how did you restrain yourself?
Yeah.
Because this guy was talking about opals or something.
So we get on the shuttle, headed to the Hilton Garden Inn. And it's just me and this other guy, and a young guy, and I say to him, are you a geologist? And he's like, how'd you know I was a geologist? I said, well, I'm going to this geology field trip at Glacier National Park. He said, yeah, I am too. It should be great. And then Fred, he just happened to mention opals, and I am dying to talk to him about opals and that they don't take tens of thousands of years to form, but they form in like 6 weeks or 8-10 weeks.
Yeah. There's some on that on our list of not so old things page.
Yes. Just go to rsr.org, click on the list of not so old things. It's right at the top. It's so much fun. at any rate, because they're microbial. Opals are formed by the action of microbes on the coast in Australia. It's just so much fun to know real science.
And you're just itching to tell them this, but you know that that might not be the wisest thing to do at that time, right?
Right, because as you and I then talk through the tactics of this trip, these professional geologists are spending, you know, $1,000 or more to get there, and they're not going to hear young Earth creationists challenge the host, who are professors of geology at Montana State University and elsewhere. That's not their purpose. That's not why they're spending their money. So Walt Brown and I, we talked it through, and his associate, Brad Anderson, who is also a geologist.
Mm-hmm.
We said, okay, we're not here to challenge them. We're here to learn, to better understand their explanation of these features. But then now and then we might be able to pick off one or two here and there. So anyway, it was just a tremendous time. I developed a friendship as much as you can in a couple days with some of these neat scientists.
And you did get an opportunity afterwards, right, to talk to them one-on-one in a few small groups?
Even in, like, say, the second half of this multi-day field trip.
Yep.
And so there were three things that we looked at that I'd love to share with you, Fred. One is the Lewis Overthrust Fault. Another is the hundreds of thousands of layers, all in one location, going straight down for 30,000 feet. Little tiny layers, like in a foot or two in a meter, you might have a dozen or dozens or maybe 50 of these layers. And they have ripples in them. It's all slate. And they break apart real easily.
Yeah.
It's like silt, pure silt that was lithified, turned to stone.
Okay.
And
turned
so there's that. And then there's...
So 30,000 feet deep of this.
Of this, with almost no impurities. Just this.
Wow.
It's wild. And then the third thing is these flood mud deposits. That's what they call them.
Mm-hmm.
That are about a meter thick or so, a couple few feet thick, and that are massive. Beyond imagination of how they could possibly have formed. That's according to these guys. So let's start at the beginning with the Lewis Overthrust Fault. Early on in the modern creation movement, men like Henry Morris and others, who was brilliant at hydraulics.
Yeah.
Professor of hydraulics at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. Just brilliant.
Yeah.
And so in the early years, Dr. Morris and other creationists drew an incorrect conclusion from the data, from the strata. The evolutionists were saying, you know, their index fossils where they say, well, to date this layer of rock, you look at the fossils in it.
Yeah.
And that'll tell you how old the rocks are.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, how do you know how old the rocks are by the index fossils? How do you know the index fossils by the rocks? And it becomes circular right away.
Yeah.
And then they do radiometric dating, and that stuff contradicts itself exceedingly. So at any rate, we've done entire shows on that. It's a fun topic. But where the geologists were saying we have this Precambrian rock up above rock that had been deposited higher in the geologic column.
Yeah. So the Precambrian is above rock
that was deposited initially higher.
According to the evolutionists, that it's younger than, so it's above it.
And while all these strata were buried at approximately the same time during the global flood, they were deposited in a geographic order, so to speak, one on top of another, and many of those being deposited simultaneously, and a lot of it being sorted after the fact, after deposition by lithofaction, but still there was an order to them. And so Morris said where the evolutionists and the geologists are saying that all this rock was originally below this other rock, they were saying they're wrong. That can't be, because he's an expert in hydrology. How do you move that much rock, a mountain's worth of rock, mountain ranges worth of rock on top of other layers that were originally above? He said it can't be. Well, he's wrong, because it is.
Interesting.
It is. They're right. All of the young Earth movement now agrees that Henry Morris was wrong, even ICR that he founded and CRS. He was wrong. And these layers that were deposited earlier or lower are now on top of layers deposited later. And perhaps I'll post a photo that I took from Glacier where you see an entire mountain and it's now on top of stuff that it had been under. So
Henry Morris agrees now too.
He agrees now too, right? Because he's with the Lord in heaven.
He is.
And he understands the fountains of the great deep.
Yes.
And that they were not the fountains of magma of the great deep, but they're the fountains of the great deep. So at any rate, the old earth geologists are explaining their model of how this happens. And they believe that these mountains began to push up over these layers, over layers that were above them, at the rate of about your fingernail grows, like about an inch per year, roughly speaking. And so how does that happen? Because if you're pushing rock, rock is only so strong. It's real strong, but it's only so strong. And if you tried to push more than 8 miles worth of rock, it would crush on the leading edge. So you'd have mountains of gravel.
Yes, absolutely.
You wouldn't have mountain ranges. In Glacier National Park, the Lewis Overthrust Fault at that point northward has been offset, pushed on top of strata that had been above it, 80 miles, for 80 miles of this.
Wow.
And as you go north into Canada, it goes up to 120 miles, hundreds of feet thick. And so this is powerful evidence of cataclysm.
Mm-hmm.
So Walt Brown, who's a brilliant mechanical engineer from MIT, got his PhD there, young earth creationist.
And was a leading government scientist too, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
He ran one of the scientific facilities for the U.S. government.
Yeah, Freddie was the director of the Binet Laboratories for the Army, and he had under him, reporting to him, a couple hundred scientists, dozens of PhDs. He was also a full colonel with the Air Force. He was an Army Ranger, and he was the chief of science and technology studies at the Air War College.
Wow.
So he's the real
he's
deal.
Brilliant guy.
Yes. So to hear this professor of geology from Montana State University, real likable guys. I mean, we had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
But they said this happened over a period of 15 million years. Gradually, this was pushed on top of the strata that had been higher. And so Walt Brown is explaining that if there's more than 8 miles, the rock is going to crumble because of the compressive strength of rock. And you guys like to think it was going downhill, but in your model, it's not going downhill. Just look. And you like to think it was riding on water, groundwater that's seeping where they're crossing over one another.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't keep groundwater under that kind of pressure enough to levitate mountains practically to almost zero friction for 15 million years. The water's just going to leak out.
Yeah.
It's going to leak out everywhere.
So he's telling them this in the, like a individual setting or small groups?
Yes. With the leaders of the field trip and
others. So
what's
their reaction?
Well, they're...
Do they know that Walt Brown's a young earth creationist at this point or not?
The organizer of the field trip did.
Okay.
I think by the end of that trip, then, yes, I think most of them knew. But, of course, they disagreed. They can't possibly agree.
Exactly.
Yeah. But in Walt's model, the cataclysmic event of the cracking of the Earth's crust in the mid-oceanic ridge and then the rising up of the Atlantic from the subterranean chamber 60 miles below the crust, rising up and the sinking of the Pacific.
Yep.
To accommodate the rock rising in the Atlantic.
The Atlantic rising and the Pacific is sinking.
Sinking. And beneath it, in that subterranean chamber, the water is supercritical. And supercritical water is like sliding on nothing. It's virtually zero friction. And so you have this 60, 80-mile differential, which is why North and South America slid to the Pacific and why Asia and Africa slid to the Pacific. And you have beneath it supercritical water. And so we have a great video on this. It's at rsr.org. Click on the YouTube link and our science playlist. It's right there. The global flood and the hydroplate theory.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So this happened catastrophically, not over millions of years. And Fred, we've covered the Heart Mountain Detachment, which is near Yellowstone in Wyoming. And that thing broke up. That's a mountain that broke up into like 50 pieces over an enormous area, like hundreds of square miles. And mainstream geologists have now acknowledged it happened in about, not 7 million years, in about 30 minutes.
30 minutes.
So
yeah, that's right.
So there's an example of how something catastrophic.
I could see those guys coming around to saying this happened rapidly, but then that they won't admit to a global flood. You know, like they will admit to a global flood
right.
on Mars.
Right.
But they know admitting to a global flood is, uh-oh, we're going towards that guy that's written
Moses.
About this. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and early secular geologists said the goal is to get rid of Moses because
yes.
geology as a discipline began with flood geology.
Yes.
And the early brilliant geologists who pretty much had very straightforward explanations to features around the world that were valid, that now they're returning to those. Because we see the evidence of catastrophic flooding, which is the cause of so many features of the Earth's surface.
We'll get to talk to Moses someday. That'll be cool.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be just awesome?
Yeah.
Wow. So, Fred, the next thing, the flood mud deposits. I even have recording. I took photos, video, audio of different parts of the trip, especially trying to get Walt Brown. Now, these geologists are not there to pose for a photographer,
mm-hmm.
and neither is Walt Brown. Walt is all about business.
Yeah.
You know, he's a former Army Ranger. He's a paratrooper.
Yeah.
He's not up for posing for cameras.
Yep.
But I think of it as the history of science.
History of science.
For archival history. Purposes, mm-hmm. to get Walt Brown, who's 79 years old and as strong as could be and as bright as could be, and still working and developing his model, the hydroplate theory, whatever I could get of Walt interacting, of him observing these features, I got what I could. And I have audio of this professor of geology saying, one of the leaders of the field trip, there's a dozen secular geologists there, that there are these flood mud deposits, and he pointed out one that's about a meter thick, and he said, the scope of these flood deposits is off the scales.
And he is calling them flood deposits.
Yeah, off the scales, these mud deposits that are up to about a meter thick or so, and there are different layers of them, it's beyond our ability to comprehend the enormity of the flood. How did these things, how were they generated?
Wow.
And I loved it. Because our friend down in Dallas, the geologist with ICR, Henry Morris's group, mm-hmm. Tim Clary. Fred, Tim is doing something that's the geological equivalent of sequencing the human genome. He's doing something that's never been done before. It's Tim and a homeschool student. They've been working on this for years. They are documenting, building a 3D model, a database of all the strata on all the continents all over the world. It is brilliant.
Wow.
It is powerful. And even though Tim is not a hydroplate theory proponent,
mm-hmm.
he supports CPT,
yep. that
plate tectonics thing. And so, Tim, you're going to feel bad when that thing dies.
Yeah.
But Tim Clary is going to make discoveries about the deposition of flood fossils and about the strata and the pattern that they form, not only regionally and continent-wide, but globally. He is making discoveries that no one in history has made before.
So from what I understand, he's actually presented this at a secular conference, right?
Yeah, one secular geology conference. And the geologists there were just thrilled to hear that somebody's doing this.
Yeah.
But it's not quite ready for mainstream publication.
Mm-hmm.
But he has finished most of the continents of the Earth.
Wow.
And he has shared with me, with many other creationists, the preliminary results, and they're just awesome. But what these guys don't know, who are leading geologists, highly respected, what they don't realize is the continental scope of these strata that they're talking about.
The continental scope.
It's just stunning. So what they acknowledge is off the scales. Incomprehensible how you could get flood deposits of this size, this magnitude.
Yeah.
They don't know the half of it,
that.
Fred. They
yeah.
don't know. Wait till they see it all.
Yeah.
And it takes a creationist to do the work because the work doesn't support the old earth geological uniformitarianism, because as these guys admitted at Glacier National Park, it's off the scales.
Off the scale.
You can't do it. Like the volcanoes, when you compare Mount St. Helens to the flood volcanoes and early on at that time of judgment, global judgment, Mount St. Helens is like the tiniest little pea shooter.
Yeah. Look what it did.
Right, exactly. So at any rate, that was fun to hear. And then lastly, I don't know the term for this, but we spent hours looking at these deposits. Today, it's all slate. If you hit it with a hammer, it's going to break into pieces. Yep. And the pieces are sort of rectangular and very sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And there's millions of them laying at the base of the cliffs that have been exposed by erosion and uplift. And if you hit them with a hammer in the park, you're in trouble. But so we went outside of the park.
Yeah.
Where it's all along the highway. And Fred, they're 30,000 feet deep. And I challenge Tim Clary, or I challenge the CPT geologists like John Baumgartner, to explain this formation. It is a massive inland lake or sea. There's a dispute among secular geologists.
Mm-hmm.
Massive. And it was only about 2 to 3 feet deep. And they say that because the layers all have ripples on them. So to get ripples, it can't be deep.
It can't be real deep.
It has to be very shallow, but massive in its circumference. And these layers, to say thousands of layers, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
They use the word millions. They say there are
millions.
Well,
they're used to saying millions. Millions of years.
Millions, millions of years. This is a squid. Millions of years ago. So, yeah, they believe that this shallow sea or shallow lake, freshwater, some argue it was freshwater, that very thin layers of silt were deposited, almost pure deposition, like virtually no contamination, nothing else in it. And you'd get a quarter of an inch or a half an inch or an inch and a half or whatever. And then you'd get strong winds, waves, and so you'd have ripples in that layer. And then that gets buried with another layer and another layer and another layer for 100 million years. For 100 million years, the massive inland lake sea stayed just 2 feet deep.
2 feet deep for
so
that long.
One of the geologists said, well, didn't it ever just fill up? Because lakes fill up with sediments and then they're no longer lakes.
Yeah.
Didn't it?
What was the response to that?
The response was, well, no, it didn't. Yeah. That was the response.
Yeah.
And so why is it that when you get a new 1-inch layer, that the whole lake evenly, as though it's on an elevator shaft, it all sinks an inch? Then you get the next inch and the whole thing sinks an inch.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps doing that for 100 million years as though it's on a programmed, like a Sabbath elevator in Jerusalem, where it just goes floor 48, floor 47, floor 46, floor 45, just keeps going down while the layers keep building up. That explanation is unreasonable.
Oh, completely so.
Yes. And Walt Brown's explanation is that during the enormous erosion that came from beneath the crust, because even plate tectonics can't explain how you get all that erosion.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you cover the continents with, say, 1,000 feet of sediments, you can't re-erode sediments below them. They're protected. Once you got 100, 200 feet, they're protected. So we need an average of a mile deep. In this place, 6 miles deep of sediments. And so during the catastrophe of the global flood, the erosion of rock from below the crust came up with the fountains of the great deep.
So that's what explains the erosion from beneath. It's the fountains of the great deep.
Yes. And so that's where the raw material for the sedimentary layers came from. And because of liquefaction, which is the sorting of material in water-laden sediments after it's buried, after the sediments were buried, they continued to sort.
Yes, after they're buried.
Fossils in them continued to move.
And in Walt Brown's book, he shows really good pictures and the explanation of how that works.
Oh, yeah. And rsr.org/liquefaction.
Yeah, that's
that could
right.
help yep. you into the study of this topic. And so within weeks, all those layers formed almost simultaneously. They're mm-hmm. all forming at about the same time, thousands of layers at once, because as waves are going over, the peak of the wave forces water into the sediments. The trough of the wave pulls the water back out. Actually, the water's forced back out.
Mm-hmm.
And that sorting after deposition adds to the stratification. So that's how you end up with so many layers and all of the same, almost without contamination, because oddball things tended to not get collected because minerals of similar density, just like fossils with their specific gravity, things tend to be sorted in global floods. And that's why you have sequences of layers, and sometimes they'll repeat. Very unusual, nothing like yeah, it forming yep. today, but you'll have the same sequence over 3, 4, 10 times over.
Yeah. And so CPT, catastrophic plate tectonics, they have a real hard time with this, right? With the whole erosion thing. Dr. John Morris was here, and his explanation for the erosion, you could tell he was really having a hard time, in my opinion. I mean, you know, I'm trying to give him a break here, but a bunch of tsunamis.
Tsunamis.
That's, just kind of, that's to me a just-so story.
Yeah.
You know, that's just kind of creating something to try to explain this evidence.
Right. And so if you want to explain all the mile deep of sedimentary rock on average all over the continents of the world, and you want to explain it with, say, tsunamis or ocean currents, real quickly then you could only erode the edges of the continents.
The edges. That's right.
You can't erode all of Asia. You can't erode yep. all of Africa, all of North America, because it's covered in sediments. So you have to do all the eroding from the edges of the continents, and it doesn't work geographically. It doesn't work. The sediments came from beneath the crust of the earth. And as the fountains of the Great Deep cracked the mid-oceanic ridge around the entire globe, about over 40,000 miles long, as that crack eroded away, that 60 miles tall cliffs that are crumbling, eroding, as the water is coming up from below and coming out onto the surface and shooting up even into the atmosphere and beyond, reaching escape velocity and beating up the moon.
The moon.
Especially the near side.
Causing the asteroids and the comets.
Yeah, and the TNOs.
Yep.
And the meteoroids.
Yep.
Yeah, all these deadly objects, these mavericks of the solar system.
Yep, leaving seaweed on the space station.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. We did such a fun show on RSR's apparent biological material in space, and we list a lot
yeah.
of evidence. Yep. In fact, I think it's the best place on the entire internet that lists all the evidence that there is biological material in the solar system. And we quote from Nature, the journal Nature. We quote from NASA. We quote from Earth and Planetary Science Letters and other sources where they say very unexpectedly they're finding evidence, signs of organic life and organic compounds that they're shocked to find.
Yeah.
And even
organic compounds that came from Earth, right?
Well, we know they came from Earth.
Yeah.
Because we know the Bible is God's word and there was a global flood. But they don't know this.
Yes.
And so they're astounded to find the vast majority of astronomers don't believe it. They reject it all, even though it's widely reported.
Mm-hmm.
They reject it all. It's all misunderstanding of the data. But I mean, come on. The journal Nature, going back as far as 1978, that light comes with the signature of cellulose dust.
Yes.
Cellulose. Yes. Up to the journal Nature and NASA in 2010, that they have identified long-chained molecules, which are the building blocks of life, on an asteroid.
Yeah.
And a lot of evidence like that.
Yeah. Evidence doesn't matter to them if it contradicts their religion. Remember when Schweitzer discovered or the soft tissue in dinosaurs?
Right.
She had one scientist that said, he doesn't believe it. He doesn't believe the evidence. And she goes, what evidence could I present that you would believe? Is there any evidence that you'd believe that it's soft tissue, of original soft tissue? And he said, there's none. No evidence would show him.
Right.
Because he was committed to his religious belief.
His worldview, his bias, in fact, it's blind faith.
Yeah.
That you are committed to when you reject the Creator God. So, Fred, we're about out of time, but talking then to these geologists, one-on-one, two, three, we go for lunch, go for dinner, have long walks at night after dinner. Like, I took a half-hour walk with one geologist on a couple occasions, and we talked about it all.
Oh,
the
good.
Whole thing.
Oh, good.
Dinosaur soft tissue, carbon 14 in diamonds, opals, everything.
Was a lot of this like totally new to them, or had they kind of heard it before, or what was their reaction?
Shock.
Really?
No one had ever heard that paleontologists have found red blood cells, blood vessels, soft tissue proteins in dinosaur bones. They'd never heard that.
Wow.
Even the guys and the grad students who go to Montana State University, where Jack Horner worked, even the ones who knew Jack Horner, we talked to them about their relationship with him. They never heard of that. They never heard of it.
Well, you wonder how many seeds you planted. You know, hopefully a couple of those will break out of that matrix.
Yeah.
And,
well, there was one gal from Japan.
Okay.
Professional geologist. And I asked her at dinner, there were a few of us, and I said, do women in Japan like diamonds? And she smiled. She had very broken English, but such a great communicator. Mm-hmm. And she said, we love diamonds. we really do. And I said, do they have carbon 14 in them? And she laughed and she said, no, of course not. Carbon 14 would not last that long.
Mm-hmm.
I said, how old are diamonds? And they had a discussion and they agreed they're hundreds of millions of years to a billion years or more.
Yeah.
And I said, well, they've been tested and they have carbon 14 in them.
Yeah. They always do. Almost always. Right.
And they're in shock because we had a good enough of a relationship by then where these people believed I wasn't just making this up.
Yeah.
Like this one geologist, his job is to find gold deposits. So I asked him, are you familiar with the paper that reports that gold precipitates in veins in not thousands of years or millions, but in less than a second? Less than a second? And he said, no, I haven't heard that one. So I said, well, do you want to look at this? And Fred, I turned my cell phone to him and I showed him from the journal Nature, Nature Geoscience,
flash vaporization during earthquakes evidenced by gold deposits.
Yes.
That's the title of the article.
Flash vaporization. And they explain in the article, you got to count it in microseconds. In less than a second, gold precipitates in the cracks through the strata during earthquakes.
Wow. So what was his reaction?
He was stunned in a very positive way.
Yeah.
He was extremely thankful. He asked me to mail him the link, which I did right then and there. And so there were a number of instances where the conversation would go a certain direction in their direction.
Yeah.
And Walt Brown or Brad Anderson or I knew what they're talking about explicitly and even knew more about it than they did on that particular topic.
Wow. That is so cool.
So there was at least enough friendship and trust that we're not making it up.
Yeah.
We might disagree.
Yeah.
But we have the same reliable sources they have. And so, Fred, the dinosaur soft tissue stunned the geologist that I talked with. And I showed them the photos. And then we would talk through it for 5-10 minutes. And they understood the implications.
Yeah.
It was very uncomfortable. And the opals forming in weeks, not 100,000 years or tens
did
of thousands
come
of
up?
Years. Yes.
So you did get to bring that good.
Yes. And the carbon 14 everywhere it's not supposed to be, including in diamonds, which they agreed you're not going to contaminate the center of a diamond.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a wonderful trip overall. It was an honor to be there with Brad Anderson and Dr. Walt Brown. It was just an awesome time.
Oh, man. That sounds great, Bob.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that, hey, we get one, two, maybe all of them, if we're real fortunate to, come to the truth, come to the easy side.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like shooting apples in a barrel.
Yeah.
We've got so much overwhelming evidence on our side. It is so cool.
Yeah. It's just the best. So thank you, Fred Williams.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for going on that trip.
Oh, you're so very welcome. You know, I was supposed to go on a science expedition halfway around the world. It's been postponed, it looks like, till 2017. So, you know, we'll let people know what happens with that.
Okay.
But instead of going halfway around the world, we went up to Montana.
16th way around the world.
Yeah, it was just great. So thank you, Fred Williams. And this is Bob Enyart for Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.